Fred Film Radio. Silent Film Festival, Pordenone, Italy.
Fred Film Radio, I'm Matt Micucci from the 2017 Giornate del Cinema Muto, and that's the Pordenone Silent Film Festival. And I'm very pleased to be joined by Russell Merritt. First of all, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
You'll be dedicating the Jonathan Dennis Memorial Lecture to the film preservationist David Shepherd. But our listeners may not be familiar with them at all, so quite simply my question is, what could you tell us about him?
Well, you don't have to be unknowledgeable about film not to have heard of David Shepherd. He kept a very low profile, and so it's not surprising that your listeners might not have ever heard of him, or that even those who have been attending the Giornate for years might not have ever heard of him. He never published anything. His film company, Film Preservation Associates, never had a website, and yet he is one of the major architects of film preservation and film distribution. Your listeners may have heard of Kevin Brownlow or Martin Scorsese. David Shepherd is the third in that trinity of heroes for silent film and historical film preservation. It's very difficult to sum up in a sentence or two his career. It was so widely diverse. He was a film teacher. He ran his own company, Film Preservation Associates, which, again, your listeners might know from the distribution that his films get. He has distributed well over 2,000-3,000 films, and through Lobster Films and through an organization called Flickr Alley. And but beyond that, he was a teacher. He was one of the original members of an organization called American Film Institute, for whom he rescued some 8,000 films from studios and private collectors. He was a film teacher at the University of Southern California. When he was at the Directors Guild, he literally reoriented what this professional organization was up about. The Directors Guild of America is an organization made by and for directors to do the usual things that guilds and unions do to get their members recognition, higher salaries, better contracts. What David introduced was something called special projects. And if he had done nothing else, that would be remarkable. Among the other things he did was create a school at the Directors Guild where faculty members like me, I teach at the University of California at Berkeley, get to spend 1 week, all expenses paid, in Hollywood, going on sets to watch how films get made, how television productions get made, talk with directors, writers, and the people that we call below the line, that is, script writers and technicians and other people whose activities make up film production. That was something that David started. And we academics really benefited from that, because you suddenly got a sense of how the product that you are trying to teach literally got made. If you have seen a Chaplin film, if you have seen a D.W. Griffith film, if you have seen a European silent film, the chances are David Shepherd had something to do with its restoration or its distribution. That may be the best way to put it. Although he didn't limit himself to silent films were his special passion.
And I wonder where that passion for films came from. Do you even know?
A very young age. He started collecting movies when he was still a teenager, and it was a much different era. He was growing up in the 1950s when camera stores, major camera stores, would rent films, and television took the bottom out of that, because people were no longer interested in renting 8mm and 16mm movies for their homes, they could watch television. So David got started by buying from these photography stores their backlog of films. And by the time he was out of high school, he was already starting to restore them and to see what he could do in making them more available. He joins the American Film Institute, which was created in the early 60s in order to preserve films. And I may have mentioned that for the American Film Institute, he saved something like 8,000 titles from the studios that didn't know what to do with these films and from private collectors. So that was the start, and then it just grew. Your listeners may or may not have heard of Black Hawk Films. That was one of the companies that he joined, and he turned it from a kind of a home movie service that specialized in Laurel and Hardy and Chaplin and Buster Keaton, anything they could find. He transformed that into finding better prints of those directors and actors, but also bringing in documentaries, foreign films, expanding the repertoire so that you at home could buy a print of The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, The Birth of a Nation, Chaplin mutual comedies. That was all part of the legacy.
It's really amazing to just hear about how many things he actually did. I was just wondering how you met him and what influence he had on your career.
Yeah, everything practically connected. My connection with David was so much fun that it started with a phone call. I was teaching at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and I get a phone call from this fellow in Davenport, Iowa. The only reason anybody would have heard of Davenport, Iowa is that Bix Beiderbecke was from Davenport, and the Davenport Blues is one of his great riffs. But usually Davenport is known for its beer and for its bowling alleys. But David had acquired for Black Hawk Films a library of the Fox Movietone News. This is so typical of David. So he finds these films in Hollywood. He then figures out that the man who narrated, in those days you had newsreels that came with every film program, and they would be narrated by various famous voices. And the most famous voice was Lowell Thomas. Lowell Thomas is the man who invented Lawrence of Arabia, and as I say, he was the senior voice of Fox Movietone News. And he was still alive, living in a penthouse in New York. David finds an arrangement in, I think, Georgia, so that he's going to take these Fox Movietone newsreels and devote 1 year per program from the 20s all the way up for the 40s. So he's calling me because Lowell Thomas, the program is called Lowell Thomas Remembers. Lowell Thomas can't remember anything. And so we are to write scripts together in order to help Lowell remember. And it was weird to hear Lowell Thomas recalling, and then what he'd recall is something David and I had written. And so David would come up to Madison, I would go down to Davenport, Iowa, and we'd watch the newsreels of the year, bang out our scripts, send them to the South, and that began a relationship that lasted 40 years. And the reason I take your time up with this is that it was altogether typical of these creative projects that David would create in order to make silent film, and in this case, sound film, come alive again.
Well, that really sounds exciting to me, as well as very interesting. It sounds like it was an exciting time.
Oh, it was, because silent film hadn't really been discovered as it has been today. There were no equivalents of the Giornate di Cinema Muto or the San Francisco Silent Film Festival. And so David was very much a kind of Johnny Appleseed or a Father Christmas to just bringing these films to film societies, talking about them, making contracts with television programs just to keep them going. And there is no place he would not go that he wouldn't bring a film and want to talk it up. He was always passionate about his work, and he never distributed a film that he just didn't care passionately about. That was part of the fun.
I know that this festival has done so much to promote silent film. It really has, because it's hard to believe that, like, before it was around and before it started showing films, I think the perception that people had of silent film is that it was a lesser type of cinema. Still needed to be completed.
It was shown at the wrong speed. It was shown usually or sometimes without music. It was victims of films that were 50, 60 years old. If you look that bad as when you're 50, you'll know what the problem is. And suddenly there was this movement to show them as they were originally shown, with orchestras, with ensembles, with pianists who had created special scores for them, to show them at the correct speed, to show them in gorgeous restored prints. David was part of that. Kevin Brownlow was an absolute architect for that, and several other very important names who were all honored at the Giornate. They have a Jean Mitry Award that is kind of an award for those outstanding contributors. And the Giornate is in a league of its own. There would be no San Francisco Silent Film Festival had it not been for the Giornate. There would be, in my country, no Denver Silent Film Festival without the Giornate. And part of it is just the personalities of its organizers. These are their own Johnny Appleseeds, their own Father Christmases, who are just so dedicated to putting silent film back on the map.
And now, as a final question, sure. I'd like to talk about A Flashlight by D.W. Griffith, which was presented at the festival. Yeah, and I think it's like it's nice to talk about this film because, like I mentioned before the interview, it's not the best D.W. Griffith film. It's not necessarily his most important film, but it's also it represents something at the festival that shows all of silent cinema.
That's a great way to phrase it. What people know about D.W. Griffith, if they know anything about D.W. Griffith, is he's the man behind The Birth of a Nation. But before he made Birth of a Nation, he made 485 one- and two-reel films. That is, films that are 10 to 20 minutes long. And this is one of them, A Flash of Light. It's one of three films he made that week. And so it's not going to be a masterpiece every time he releases them. Some of them are masterpieces. This is not one. but it is a very strange film and a very interesting one about what happens to an artist who is blinded. And in a nutshell, what's happening is that because he's blind, he doesn't realize that this rather worthless woman is doing him no favors, but that his wife, who he is rather dismissive of, pretends to be the other woman, and in so doing provides him with services. Now, the end is the true melodramatic finale, where he is finally going to see the light by having the bandages taken off. And in that 30 seconds where he sees the light, he recognizes that his wife is his real hero and that the painted lady is not for him. And then he goes blind again. So she
incurably.
Gets, yeah, incurably blind because of light that is coming out of the window. Well, you couldn't you couldn't do better than this for just rank melodrama. And Griffith pulls it off. It is, I don't think you find it boring. You just find it just bizarre. And that was part of Griffith's gift, is to find in bizarre stories something of interest, something of human nature. These performances, especially by the wife, are remarkable. And it is very hard to act in a silent film. That is not given to many people to know how to do this well. And part of Griffith's incredible contribution is to show performers how to adapt their theatrical training to something suitable for silent film. Not for the kind of movies we make today, but for movies in which you had to tell your story in 10, 15 minutes, in which there was no dialogue, there was no usual kinds of crutches for presenting a performance, and make something that was not laughable, but really moving and in depth. And Flash of Light is a sort of step towards creating this quieter style. So there's a lot to admire in this film without going overboard to say that this is one of the masterpieces. 485 films.
That's a lot of films. I thank you very much for joining us and talking with us. It was a real pleasure.
Matt, the pleasure was mine. Thanks so much for inviting me.
And this is Fred Film Radio, the Festival Insider.
Fred Film Radio, 24/7 on Fred.fm and smartphone apps.